I'm so not finished having this conversation with Agnes Martin's pieces. I just really just became so close to her work and her background, and just was basically felt like I just talked to her. I was having some kind of conversation with her and her work that really helped me, actually.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet Victoria Chang, author of With My Back to the World, a collection that engages with the paintings and writings of celebrated abstract artist Agnes Martin. This book explores the nature of the self, something Martin herself explored expansively through painting, and Victoria adds to a growing list of books in conversation with Martin's work, including the poets Brian Teer and Lauren Camp. Victoria is no stranger to working within some of poetry's restrictive forms, and ultimately finds creative and emotional freedom in Martin's grids and squares, writing not only ekphrastic poetry for this new collection, but allowing visual art and poetic erasures to sit alongside her text. Victoria Chang's previous book of poetry is The Trees Witness Everything, and her nonfiction book, Dear Memory, was published in 2021. Obit, published in 2020, received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Anisfield Wolf Book Award in Poetry, and the Penn Veckler Award. It was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Griffin International Poetry Prize. Victoria has received a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Choudhury Prize in Literature. Victoria, thanks so much for being here today. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thanks. It's nice to be here again.
I'd like to start our conversation with a reading. So will you read the first poem in the collection, With My Back to the World, 1997?
I'd be happy to. With My Back to the World, 1997. This year, I turned my back to the world. I let language face the front. The parting felt like a death. The first person ran away like a horse. When the first person left, there was no second or third person as I had originally thought. All that remained was repetition and blue things. This year, I stopped shaking the rain off of umbrellas and nothing bad happened. The terror of this year was emptiness, but I learned that it's possible for a sentence to have no words, that the meaning of a word can exist without the word, that life can still occur without a mind, that emptiness still swarms without the world, that it can be disconnected from the wall and still light up. The best thing about emptiness is if you close your eyes in a field, you'll open your eyes in a field.
Victoria, why were or are Agnes Martin's paintings the best mirrors for your grief, your sadness, or in the case of this poem, your emptiness?
Her grids just really moved me when I was in sort of a harder period of my life, which was this period when I was writing these poems. And there was just something about the way that they were so regular and so calculated. And she even had sort of her little math calculations, you know, next to some of the pieces or in the back of them or just, you know, on papers that really just appealed to me. When I finally looked at the pieces again, after many years of not really connecting with her paintings and her work as much, during this period, I felt like the lines, it's a strange thing to say, but I felt the lines literally just like I was able to walk into the paintings and I walked into the lines. So I felt like the lines sort of cut through me and I connected with the work in a really interesting way. She had some mental health things that she was dealing with and she, you know, left New York and I feel like it's all in her work. And then toward the end of her life, you know, she was doing all of these other paintings that were more colorful and about happiness and those kinds of things. So I think her emotional state just sort of went along with her life, and the grids in particular really resonated with me, given the emotions that I was sort of grappling with at the time.
So then what was the impetus for the first poem written in this collection? What was the aha moment for you where you were like, okay, what I am going through is mirroring or it exists in the same kind of emotional state as these paintings? What was that first poem like? And why did you decide then to engage further?
I mean, I think it's a great question. It was a weird way to start because the MoMA had commissioned a poem. And they said, hey, pick a painting or a piece of artwork, pick anything. And so I spent like a good couple hours looking around in their catalog of what was available and had written down all these pieces I thought were really interesting. But nothing was really just connecting with me. And it was such a laborious process. And then I thought, let's go reverse that process and think backwards. Like who on what artists are you interested in? What are you thinking about? What are you feeling right now? And Agnes Martin was the first name that popped into my head. And so I just, you know, searched on their site and there were a whole bunch of pieces that I was able to write a poem on. So I picked On a Clear Day in 1973, which is just a series actually of grids, pieces that were all grids of different sizes and shapes. And I kind of picked the one that just resonated with me the most. And I wrote a poem, and it wasn't until I read that poem aloud many, many, many months later at the Napa Valley Writers Conference. And I sat down and I just felt like, I don't know, just that moment of the sun and the wind and just quietly sitting there. I was like, I'm so not finished having this conversation with Agnes Martin's pieces. And I just went back to my house and I just immersed myself in her artwork and in her writings that I had read a long time ago. And just I just really just became so close to her work and her background, and just was basically felt like I just talked to her. I was having some kind of conversation with her and her work that really helped me actually. And I found it to be such a beautiful and wonderful process.
I imagine with a project book like this, and I don't know that you were writing towards a collection when you were engaging with her paintings at first, but I mean, eventually I imagine that you realized you were writing a whole of something. I'm wondering then what or who kept you safe in those spaces of writing and grief?
Yeah. I've just been writing about grief for so long now because my parents were sick for so long and ill for so long. And so it's kind of like, I don't know what else to write about because that's kind of all I've been dealing with. And my dad, my dad was sort of unbeknownst to me sort of at the time, he was kind of getting close to the end. And so I was feeling really bad about everything and it had been so long. And so I feel like in some odd way, grief was a safe space for me. I allowed myself a long time ago to feel sad and not apologize for it, and to feel sad and grief, just sort of embody grief for as long as I felt like I wanted to, and I felt like my body needed to. And so it was very welcoming. I felt like Agnes Martin's pieces and her writings welcomed me into that space, and it was unapologetic. And I felt like something about the way she navigated the world and also the way she lived her life and the things that she believed in and the way that she practiced her art very much so was something I could really connect to always, but especially at that time. And yeah, I mean, I think in terms of like the whole project book idea, I think I just don't think about writing that way. You know, I just think about obsessions, and I feel like, you know, poets have mixed feelings about the project book, whereas visual artists don't seem to have, you know, mixed feelings about Picasso's Blue Period or Calder's Mobiles or Alice Neal's portraits. I mean, I could go on, and I feel more connected with the way that those obsessions manifest themselves in series and refractions of similar sort of things. And so I think my books tend to just do that. I just write one poem and then I write another one and then I write another one. And I just keep having this kind of deeper and refracted conversation with something that I'm obsessing about until I have like a whole series of like the Blue Period, or not to at all to compare myself to any of these artists, but you know what I'm saying. So I think for me, it just, it's like one foot in front of the next. I don't usually think about the end thing at all.
I like what you said about kind of stepping into your grief and being sort of unapologetic about it, just inhabiting it as long as you needed to, because as you kind of said, Agnes Martin was kind of unapologetic, just the way she lived. She kind of did what she wanted to do. And if it was against other people's ideas of what a woman or an artist or what have you were doing at the time, she just seemed to be uncaring about it. It was what she was going to be doing. So it makes a lot of sense that the two of you would be in conversation in this kind of bold but sort of tender way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I tend to just really connect with people who just, like, the sheep are that way and they are that way. And I think I don't go against sort of the grain on purpose. I think I'm very much so in the grain many times. But when I feel like I need to do something and it feels kind of funny and I know people might think it's weird or strange, I just do it. You know, one of the things that I remember thinking is like, oh, if I write that word depression, I'm going to just totally, like, people are going to say things about it or judge me, or I might feel embarrassed about it or shame. It was actually quite freeing. Once I wrote that word down, it's like I wrote it over. It just kept on coming out on its own. And I was thinking, this is a beautiful thing. Like, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's okay. Everybody feels these things and everybody goes through really hard times, and just go ahead and name it. And then that's a form of freedom and agency. And I really felt that. Now that the book's out, some of my friends who've read it are like, everybody takes something different from it. And some of my friends have asked me, they're like, this book is so sad. And I don't even think it's that sad. And then other people will say, oh my gosh, this book is interacting with blah, blah, blah. Like, so I guess I'm really interested in seeing what people take from the book. And it's different for everybody. And the things that I felt maybe uncomfortable with, you know, sometimes people don't even notice. So I guess I'm just saying I totally believe in the idea that you must just do what feels right to you as an artist. Otherwise, there's like such a strong loss of the self and the soul in that process of making.
I just can't help but think, you know, Agnes Martin kept talking about how her paintings were in response to, or a reaction to, or, you know, about this idea of an emotion without a cause. And often she leaned into happiness so much. So many of her paintings, I feel like, could be not misinterpreted, but interpreted in a different way. You know, they're really, really subtle. How would you respond to that idea that of art created from emotion without cause, kind of just static emotion?
I love that phrase, emotion without cause, because it kind of also is sort of an anti-causal argument, right? I mean, I think there's also no logic to art making, and there's no reason why we do it. It comes from a mysterious but essential place that we have no idea where it is, but it's something in us that's also outside of us. Since the beginning of time, almost, we've been scratching on stone walls. And there's what is this desire to scratch? And Agnes Martin scratched. She scratched her, those are scratches. They're no different than my scratching and the scratching of the people in the caves. And what is this desire to scratch and then look for material on which to scratch? There's no cause. It just comes from within a deep well and outside of us. We make art to answer the larger questions that can never be answered, which is why are we here? And what are we supposed to do with our time here? Who the hell knows? I ask myself that question every single day and I have no answer. But asking myself that question every single day allows me to get through my day, which sometimes can be incredibly difficult and challenging and sad. And so I think it's very helpful to think about that importance of art in our lives and what it means. And it's something much beyond us, all of us.
You're listening to A Conversation with Poet Victoria Chang. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Elk River Books in Livingston, Montana, offering new, used, and rare books and frequent author readings in their lineup of events offered each season. A full events calendar and online shopping can be found at elkriverbooks.com. You write in the book, "Why is language the only thing that I have, or the only thing I have?" And there are visual components to these poems, not only the way that you formatted them on the page, but a lot of these poems have a visual component along with them, kind of a, I might call them like a type of erasure on the opposite page. Is that the impulse that you were following, this idea that like, okay, these words aren't quite getting it, I'm going to supplement with this visual too?
Maybe. I mean, I felt just like, I think that's, you know, I just felt like this desire to cross things out, but I didn't want to cross the poems out, but I did end up crossing them out, but in something different. Mostly it was their vellum. So originally the idea was to have vellum and then you can see through it on the other side, but obviously vellum is so expensive. So I ended up taking a photo of the art piece over the poems. But yeah, I just wanted to keep scratching. And I don't know where that impulse comes from, but maybe it's just this, like, I can't stop interacting with what I'm thinking about. And it's not, words aren't just, they're just not quite getting me there. So let me try another way.
I'm going to pivot and ask you, where are you, Victoria, in relation to the line today?
I am not having a great relationship with the line these days. My line is very prose like, and I have been writing prose poems since Obit. So Obit was all prose poems, and then the Tonkas were syllabic counting, so that doesn't count. And then the Trees Witness Everything, the Little Book of Miniature Poems, are all syllabic, so those are fake line breaks. And the same goes with the manuscript that I'm working on now. They're just couplets, but they're kind of arbitrary line breaks. And it's like intentionally arbitrary, where I'm not like, I'm not breaking them like that intentionally. So it's funny because I was thinking about how I have a funny relationship with the line these days. And so I wrote a talk on the line break to try and kind of re-engage with the line, because I think the line is super amazing and cool, as I've been reading a lot of George Oppen and Laureen Niedeker. We have a poetry group that meets, and we've been reading Laureen Niedeker, who did these really cool line breaks. And so I just am not that engaged with the line break these days, but I'm happy to let it fall where it falls.
Okay, I'm going to follow up with the same exact question, but I'm going to quote you in the book from a poem called Perfect Happiness. Agnes believed in living above the line. Above the line is happiness and love. She said that below the line is all sadness and destruction. So if we're not talking about the poetic line, which is the direction you went to in that question, if we're going to the painted line, how would you answer that question differently?
Gosh, I don't even know how to answer that question. What page is that on? So I can take a look at it.
Yeah. It's page 65. And I, this is maybe a side note. You quoted Agnes Martin, and I presume that you were quoting her from the documentary about mm-hmm. her. Yeah, I watched that. And this is a question I had for you maybe towards the end of the conversation, but I'll ask it now. I'm curious about how your thoughts about her before you began writing these poems and after, how your perception of her changed through that process.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was an enigma. And I think she, I loved how she had so much conviction in her writings about her beliefs. And I don't really think she necessarily believed all of those things at any point in time. They're just a form of assertion and declarative, and the declarative in some ways maybe was her way of searching and trying to grasp onto something. I do that all the time in my poems. I love writing these random declaratives that sound really confident and seem to make a lot of sense. And then you read them, you're like, that doesn't make sense. And then I'll probably say the opposite like two poems later. And I think it's just the act of exploration and discovery and process of making versus the outcome. And I think that nothing I say is true. And I'm not even sure I believe anything that I say. And I even sometimes miss truth in my poems. And I'm sure that Agnes Martin did that similarly. And I think it's all just a process of discovery of the self and trying to figure life out in real time. So the mark that you make this morning is different than the mark you make and the same exact thing 3 hours later. And so I think that kind of fluidity is really essential to her work and her process as it is to mine. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question about the Agnes believed in living above the line, and above the line is happiness and love. And she said that below the line is all sadness and destruction. I mean, my relationship to that line is that I'm constantly toggling back and forth. And for me, that happiness and love and joy can't possibly come without intense sadness and grief and depression and all of those things. Like, you can't possibly know what joy feels like if you haven't experienced those other things. I mean, imagine a world where there was only joy all day long. We wouldn't even know that was joy. Like, we wouldn't even understand that emotion, because we wouldn't have anything to contrast and compare it to. And so, like, I'm constantly moving between, above and below the line all day. I cannot find joy, for example. It just comes to me. And happiness, you know, I feel happiness during the day quite a bit, but I also don't know when that's going to happen. So I feel like those emotions just come to me. And then the sadness for me, just because of my, you know, naturally depressive personality, and also just some of the difficulties I've experienced over a long period of time, I feel like it's sort of this thread that just kind of lives in my body or just cuts through my body all the time. And it's sort of the state of mind that I'm mostly in. And I have to remember that, go work out or go outside, or otherwise I'll feel sad, you know? And so I think that, for me, it's just sort of knowing kind of what kind of disposition I have and then being at peace with that. And then, accepting the other things where they come. If that makes sense. No, I can't go find those things. Like, I'm not going to go find happiness. It's not there. Not for me, at least. Like, it'll just arrive and I'll be like, oh, that's so great. You know,
that does make sense. Yeah. Would you be willing to read another poem?
Sure.
How about the poem on page 70, Untitled 1960?
Untitled 1960. Agnes incised her grids onto the wet blue wound. Each rectangle is marked twice with 2 carats, as if to say the grids aren't enough, that beauty must be scored twice. I used to think that love and death could be separate, that one didn't drag the other. Now I think death is the form of love. My real secret isn't that I have 2 hearts, but that I have 2 eye colors. My blue eye can see death, and my brown eye can see love. The trouble is that looking involves both eyes. When people die, the eyes still want to remain open to continue stockpiling images. Funeral homes use spiky eye cups to keep the eyes shut, as if a lifetime of sight can be contained. The images after a person dies travel, looking for a new home. Sometimes that home is a painting or an abandoned building. Other times the images are homeless for so long they bind together with images from other people and turn into memory.
I'm looking at the question that I drafted for you here, Victoria, and it's not actually a question, but maybe you can take it in a particular direction, because I'd like to talk about the way that this collection reflects on and combines often the act of seeing or sight with death and dying. Does that reading resonate with you, and what might you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like after I've seen some of the things that I've seen, it's hard for my eyes to unsee those things. And it's also hard for my eyes to forget those things while looking at other things. So it's almost as if I have a pair of glasses that are on all the time, that have now seen things that really are related to death and dying. I mean, my parents were both sick for a really long time. And I not only saw their, you know, particular daily illnesses manifest themselves and progress in different ways, but I saw the deaths of a lot of other people and dying of a lot of other people in the elder care facilities. And it's a lot of death and a lot of dying. And for better or for worse, that's what I've seen. And that's my particular fate. And so for me, seeing now, like, there's not a single thing I look at that isn't sort of through those lenses. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's hard to forget. I mean, maybe it's also, I was thinking about this as I was writing some prose, is that like there's a lot of stuff out there about, you know, post-traumatic stress related to caretaking. And I started reading about that after, because I was like, oh my gosh, I have totally, I'm traumatized, you know, by some of the experiences that I've had. And it's, you know, it'll probably take another lifetime beyond my life to sort of overcome those. If I ever could overcome those, I'm not sure I can. I know I cannot in this lifetime because of my age and also my personality. I just think that those experiences will live with me, and that's how I will view the world. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a sad thing. I don't feel sad about it at all. It's just what happened to me.
I'm going to pivot again and just ask you a question. Tell me about your relationship, Victoria, especially as it's written about in this collection, to the moon.
Lots of moons, I guess, huh? Birds and moons. You know, I don't know. I just think the moon is just the coolest thing. And I think it's so beautiful. And I feel like poets don't, why does the sun feel like a cliche in a poem? And why does, well, actually, I think some people would say the moon feels like a cliche too. But to me, it's all the rendering of it. Like the moon can be made new again and made fresh again by someone who knows how to do it. But I just love the moon. I love the nighttime. And I just think about the moon all the time. The moon is like in my brain all the time. Like even right now, it's like, where's the moon? Like I think about it. And I just feel like it's like a companion to me in some way. And I always want to write about it, maybe because it's so far away and there's only one that I can see. And the stars appear sometimes in my poems, but I'm like, oh, there's just too many of them and they're not that special. But the moon is just one. So I feel like it's my companion for sure. Yeah, it appears.
That was poet Victoria Chang, author of With My Back to the World, out now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Look for more information about Victoria at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.